This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hi.
Israel has been in a state of political deadlock for some time now. This week, it held its fourth election in 2 years. Sadly, the outcome doesn't appear to have solved anything. For this story, we'll turn to Brent.
Yeah, there we go again. This Tuesday, there was another election in Israel, and every time they have one of these, they get a day off. So there was what was interesting, just going around town in Jerusalem, was that you could just know there was no buzz in the air for this election compared to the others. And it turned out that there was about 5 or 6% less people turning out for this fourth go around. A lot of Israelis heading to the beach or elsewhere for the day, kind of disillusioned with the whole process, given how fractured the democratic system is over here. In the election, there was numerous parties, a lot of parties, I forget how many there were, about 40 or something like that. And one, two, three, there's about 13 of them that made the threshold to form the Knesset. That's an over 3.5% of the vote. And so it shows you how many parties there are, how fractured the system is. And then it's up to two candidates to have a chance, first one and then another, to try and bring together majority. Now, in terms of how that looks for Prime Minister Netanyahu, while his Likud party did receive by far the most individual votes, the Likud party received 30, would receive 30 Knesset seats in the next Knesset, his coalition of religious and right-wing parties still will not get a majority that's needed. They'll not reach 61. However, neither will the other leftist side, leftist anti-Netanyahu side, with some right-wing parties that just don't like Netanyahu. And so it looks like, again, we might be going to a fifth election, a rerun again, in sometime in the next 6 months. However, Netanyahu is going to get an opportunity to go ahead and try and form a coalition, and he is a master at this. He is in a better situation than he was in, I would say, after the fourth election. And that is because of this extremely wide margin that exists between him and the nearest party. The nearest party is Yesh Atid. This is led by Yair Lapid. He's been around for a long time. He claims to be a centrist, but he's more on the left. And he received only 17 Knesset seats. And so that's a good gap of 13 seats. This is the largest gap that Netanyahu has ever received between him and the next contender, which even the Jerusalem Post did say that this gap gives him a clear mandate for leadership, both domestically and internationally as well. So I think the big takeaway of this is, although we don't have a clear coalition, Netanyahu is definitely as strong as ever, and really the only person that Israelis have somewhat of an idea of or think that can lead the country through these times.
Now, politically, he may have his clearest mandate in some time, even though he doesn't have a governing coalition necessarily. But he also faces a considerable obstacle from the administration in Washington at this point.
Right. And this played out in the past couple of weeks as the prime minister was due to go to visit the UAE. This is one of the Gulf states that Israel has just signed one of the peace accords with. And this was going to be the first visit by Mr. Netanyahu, who attempted to go a couple of weeks ago, but the Jordanians, for whatever reason, didn't let him use their airspace, declined to let him use their airspace. And then a week before, the crown prince, Mohammed bin Zayed, MBZ, they call him, he said, well, I'm not going to allow myself to be as part of a political photo op for a politician of a country directly days before their election. Now, what's interesting about this, and Lee Smith at Tablet Magazine brought this out, and as did Mihailo Zekic, that writes for The Trumpet. He's got an article up right now, Biden is undermining the Abraham Accords. And it talks about how that the United States initially was invited to be there alongside representatives of the Biden administration were allowed to were invited to be there alongside Netanyahu and MDZ for this visit. And they said, yes, sounds good. But after the election, we're not going to get we don't want to show us show ourselves to be supportive of Netanyahu. And so really, as Mr. Zekic brings out and also Lee Smith brought out, it is the Biden administration that is the one that is really the strong anti-Netanyahu party here that wanted to prevent him from getting this, what would give him a boost. I mean, Israelis are sick in the Middle East of being the outcast of no one accepting them. And he had a couple of amazing peace deals with the UAE, Bahrain, and a couple others. And Israelis flocking to Dubai, Abu Dhabi, straight after that. And them, the Emiratis welcoming them. And Prime Minister Netanyahu was the one that brokered those brokered that deal. And so this would have been a good show for him. However, Washington does not like Netanyahu. It did not like him when Barack Obama was in power. State Department has rarely liked him. And now Joe Biden doesn't like him. And they're seeking a way, if they could, to not further his tenure. However, I think that the story that everybody is missing here inside the Israeli election and why he got the buffer of 13 extra mandates from Yair Lapid is because Israelis themselves are very concerned right now about the Biden administration. There has been lots of evidence that anyone can see that the Biden administration is just like Obama's and doesn't like Israel. And so who has the leadership capability to stand up to this Biden administration if it's not Netanyahu, rather successfully stood up to Obama almost a decade ago? So I think that was actually one of the reasons why he got so many votes among the Israelis, is because Israelis believe that he can navigate these waters of a very anti-Israel American administration that's in power right now.
The Abraham Accords were really quite a pillar achievement of the Trump administration. The Biden administration seems determined to undermine that, and it is consistent with the efforts that it has made to empower Iran.
Yeah, that's right. And we've noted that. I think that's been the story that we've talked about the past month. Every single story has been Iran benefiting from Biden administration's pro-Iranian policies, whether that's in Yemen with the Houthis negotiating a new nuclear deal or other instances of letting the expiration or allowing the UN Security Council resolution to negate that so that they can have weapons and arms and buy them on the open market. A lot of things the Biden administration is doing is to support Iran. And the Abraham Accords, if for nothing else, was the way that the Trump administration recognized that it could extricate itself from the Middle East. Let's get out from the Middle East and empower all the anti-Iranian forces, the Saudis, the UAE, Bahrain, Egypt, and Israel, to come together to make their own collective strategic alliance that can face up to the Iranian threat together. And that's what the Abraham Accords are starting to produce. It's an anti-Iranian alliance that's produced for peace in the Middle East to try and suffocate the Iranian regime. And that's not what the Biden administration wants. Mm-hmm. They want the opposite. They want to the Saudis to share the neighborhood. They want Israel and Iran make it seem like Israel and Iran are equally aggressive in the Middle East. Their game plan is to empower the Iranians, and it has been that way from the very get-go. So they are going to do all they can to throw a spanner in the wrench of these Abraham Accords, spanner in the works, I should say, not in the wrench, to try and blow these up so that Iran can go about what it's biblically prophesied to do, and that is to grow in power, that is to take over other nations. And there's every reason to see that Iran is going to do that with the support it gets from the Biden administration.
Thank you for that, Brent. That article by Mihailo Zekic up at thetrumpet.com. Biden is undermining the Abraham Accords. Go check that out. And moving on here, political deadlock has also been plaguing Germany, and events this week underscore just how enfeebled the current government under Angela Merkel is. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, we've seen a pretty abrupt change of direction this week from the German Chancellor Angela Merkel. So on Monday, she announced a new plan. You know, COVID cases are rising within Germany, and so she announced basically a new lockdown, albeit, I mean, they're still in lockdown, I guess I should say, a new stage of lockdown or something like that. So over the Easter weekend and a couple of weeks, everything would be completely shut. It would basically be, you know, everything's pretty much shut down in Germany on Sundays anyway. So it was going to be kind of another Sunday. Another rest day is what they called it. And shops were going to be completely closed. On some of those days, even supermarkets would be closed. She also said that churches would be closed over the Easter weekend. She got everyone together. A bunch of heads of the different states in Germany agreed to it. And then the backlash was so strong that 2 days later, she had to come out and issue a public apology. She said, "I apologize to all citizens. To put it bluntly, the idea of an Easter shutdown was designed with the best of intentions because we absolutely have to slow down and reverse the third wave of the pandemic. But it was a flawed idea. The mistake is solely my fault because in the end, I have ultimate responsibility as chancellor." She had people in backbenchers in her own party rebelling against the vote. She had Horst Seehofer, a key leader in the Christian Social Union, saying he did not support the closure of churches. In some ways, she made a kind of a pretty big political blunder by closing both shops and churches. It meant the left were mad with her over the closure of shops, and then the right was mad with her over the closure of churches. And for many on the right, that was the kind of the big significant thing. And then, as the Telegraph noted, the planned Easter shutdown has become a lightning rod for public anger over the government's botched vaccine rollout and the fact that Germany is still facing restrictions after almost 5 months of lockdown. So this is about far more than Angela Merkel making one unpopular decision. This is a big moment for her entire leadership. You know, another thing where a lot of people think that her government has got things fundamentally wrong, not just on the question of do we lock down over Easter, but in the entire coronavirus response.
Well, really, the way that Germany has been handling this, it's creating and exacerbating political problems really across the board. This has taken out a number of politicians who have been the target of this kind of backlash that you're talking about. This kind of political turmoil has really important ramifications in Germany in particular.
It does. I mean, this is an election year. We talked about this last on the program last week, even a super election year, some people are calling it, because of the number of different regional elections that are going on. And you know, we're seeing a really quick convulsion in the poll. You know, Angela Merkel has had problems in the polls before. You know, there've been the euro crisis, and she was blamed for giving too much German money to lazy Greeks. There was the migrant crisis, where she was blamed for letting in too many migrants and people didn't like that response. She regained a lot of that unpopularity at the beginning of the pandemic. You know, Germany's death toll was per capita was less than a lot of other developed nations. And so people were saying, well, OK, you know, credit where credit's due. We might disagree with her on these other things, but she's handled this competently. You know, there's a professionalism there. She might not be the most inspiring or dramatic leader, but she's done well here. With the slow rollout of the vaccine, with Germany going into a third lockdown potentially while other nations open up, that's evaporated and we've just seen a collapse. You know, some opinion polls, in some polls she's gone from, or the CDU party, her party has gone from 40% popularity to, you know, 26, 25% popularity. It's a massive shift, and it was kind of, it was almost, you know, we almost did this when we were talking on the show about, okay, well, now there's a new leader of the CDU, but it was kind of almost taken for granted. Come September, the CDU is going to be running Germany. That's not taken for granted anymore. And now we don't know. We could have a green chancellor. We've never had a green chancellor before. That's a serious possibility. And so it's just kind of thrown this election race wide open. And again, I mentioned this last time. The Green Party has two leaders, not one. The SDP has two leaders, not one. So it does kind of put us in this political limbo. And Germany's been in a lot of political uncertainty for several years. And we've talked about this a lot. The one certainty and constant has been Angela Merkel. And now she is gone, but not only is she gone, but potentially even her reputation could be on its way out too.
Mm-hmm. And just put this briefly in the context of what we are expecting based on Bible prophecy to happen politically in Germany.
So we have a free booklet called A Strong German Leader is Imminent. And that talks about a whole series of very specific prophecies that talk about a strong leader that is coming to Germany. And a strong German leader that's coming to Germany, it talks about him coming in by flatteries. And like we spoke about on last week's show, you look at what that means in the Hebrew, and this is in Daniel 11, and it means, you know, by some kind of unorthodox way. He doesn't come in through the usual legitimate channels. So this implies, well, something's gone wrong with the usual legitimate channels for somebody to come in by another way. And you see this chaos within Germany, and you really see it paving the way for this type of leader. And I'll talk about it a bit more later. We've also got another article, Coronavirus and the Holy Roman Empire, by our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, that talks about the potential for the coronavirus to pave the way for this strong leader. And I think that's really what we're seeing now with all of this turmoil in Germany.
All right. Thank you for that, Richard. We also have this article by Josue Michels, European Democracies Search for a Savior, that talk about these lockdowns in Germany and this political embarrassment suffered by Angela Merkel this week specifically. Go check that out. We'll link to that and the booklet that Richard just referred to in the show notes for today's program. More aggressive tactics by China to assert de facto control over another reef in the Philippines. For this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the Philippines has called on China to withdraw 220 ships that are moored right now in line formation near the Julian Felipe Reef, or the Whitsun Reef, which is in the Spratly Island chain. So these ships have been lashed together in this area since March 7th. And nominally, these are fishing boats, but Philippine authorities have noted that their crews are not engaged in any kind of fishing, and they are believed to be part of China's maritime militia. So that's just kind of a hybrid category that officially has civilian status, but they are armed, and they're well understood to receive and carry out military orders. Their crew are former soldiers in many cases. So the Philippines is calling for China to pull these ships out because this reef is well within the Philippines' exclusive economic zone. That's the area stipulated by international law to include 200 nautical miles off a nation's coasts. So, you know, it is lawfully part of the Philippines, but we know that China has no regard for international law. And they claim just about the entire South China Sea, where this reef is located, as their own. So there is a standoff developing here, and the United States, which is a treaty ally of the Philippines, said on Tuesday that America backs the Philippines' demands for China to back down. So that may sound somewhat reassuring, but we know that the days when China would kind of hide its strength and bide the time, those days are over. And I think that China is very unlikely to be deterred by words alone, even if those words are coming from the United States. So, you know, it's still early days, but this reef could become a flashpoint, a location of serious escalation. And it's a spot we'll be keeping a close eye on.
Yeah, the words from the United States really just underscore the hollowness of the foreign policy and the unwillingness to back such words with action. If you wouldn't mind, maybe explain the strategic importance of this reef in particular, or this area that China is securing, and in the context of the militarization of this area that China has been taking for some years.
Sure. Yes. Well, the South China Sea is, you know, it's full of shipping routes that are some of the busiest in the world, just major arteries of trade. And we know that China has built and militarized several islands in this area already, about seven, which have become fairly formidable bases. And so it just wants to be able to control eventually who can come in and go out of this sea. It wants to secure its coasts. China is completely dependent on exports and imports, imports of energy to fuel its economy, exports of everything that it manufactures. So it would be it would really wreck their economy and devastate it were there to be a naval blockade, which the U.S. at this point could possibly implement there. So that's really China's rationale for wanting to take over the various little islands, just to have military outposts to be able to prevent such a blockade from ever happening.
And the way that it has treated the Philippines, this is really the latest of a series of provocations.
Yes, it's this is a tried and true tactic that China has used. It's sometimes called salami slicing, where they go into the Philippines maritime territory and take, you know, islands one by one. It happened with Mischief Reef back in 1995. Right now, that is a formidable Chinese military base. Then back in 2012, it happened with Scarborough Shoal. The Philippine Navy caught some Chinese fishing ships anchored there. And that's another, you know, these are all features that lie well within Philippine territory. At Scarborough Shoal, that ended up being a standoff for about 2 months. And it was interesting that China had used fishing boats rather than overt military vessels, because it's a lot easier for them to kind of push with these kinds of boats. And it complicates any potential response from another country, such as the United States, because it just muddies everything. You know, the rules of engagement are considerably more difficult when one of the two parties is officially a civilian party. So I think this is all by design from China. And I think that unless the Philippines and the U.S. are willing to stand up to China's aggression with something drastic, even though these are officially civilian ships, then the Julian Felipe Reef will very soon be one more slice of salami that China cuts from another country and puts on its own plate.
These kind of aggressive maritime tactics, securing a vital sea route, and particularly from China, it has a number of prophetically significant ramifications.
It does, yes. And I think it's interesting that there are a lot of analysts who look at this and they say, you know, who cares about this little reef that nobody's ever heard of? It's not worth going to war with China over a couple of rocks out in the middle of the ocean. But Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has said that China's takeover of this region, even though it's happening gradually, it's steering the world toward war. That was in an article that he wrote in July of 2016. And one part of that article says, China has had a strategy to establish a security buffer extending far from its coast and engulfing the entire South China Sea. Its current military buildup in the Paracels and the Spratlys, which is where this this reef is located, is bringing China closer to realizing this strategy. And then from there, Mr. Fleury points out that this is all happening in a region that America has had naval dominance of for about 70 years. And he says China is now challenging all those decades of American naval dominance, and that that should, quote, alarm the world. And then a little further down, he writes, China is intimidating the nations of Southeast Asia into submission to its will. Everything is headed in the direction of war. And then Mr. Fleury's article from there explains that all of this Chinese activity is contributing to the fulfillment of a Bible prophecy about modern-day America and Britain losing control of the oceanic gates and some of the shipping routes that they long controlled. That prophecy is in Deuteronomy 28. And Mr. Fleury says, China's takeover of the South China Sea is one of many areas where onlookers today can, quote, already see this prophecy moving toward its fulfillment. So yes, as you said, there are a number of prophecies that are really working toward fulfillment with China's rise in general, but with this specific activity happening in the South China Sea, I think it's a stark example of where we can see Deuteronomy 28:52 really happening.
We will link to that article from Gerald Flurry, China is Steering the World Toward War, in the show notes for today's program, along with an article that Jeremiah has just completed on this specific subject, China's Maritime Militia Asserting Control Over Another Philippine Reef. You can read that at thetrumpet.com right now on the front page. Thank you, Jeremiah. A mass murder in Colorado this week has the left in America and the new presidential administration reaching for very familiar solutions. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, tragedy struck the United States on Monday when a deranged gunman entered the parking lot of a King Soopers supermarket in Boulder, Colorado, and began shooting at customers trying to buy groceries. Most our listeners have probably already heard this story about how the man murdered 10 people, including one police officer, before he was finally surrendered after they shot him in the leg. But the reaction to this tragedy, as you mentioned, is very telling. Anyone who had access to a social media account on Monday really saw the knee-jerk reaction to blame this shooting on white supremacy. On Monday, they didn't release the shooter's identity, but they did release a photograph of him, and he was clearly Caucasian, if you saw the photograph, which prompted a number of leftist or progressive activists and journalists to make comments like this. The actress, Rosanna Arquette, posted a comment on Twitter saying, "Call it what it is, white supremacist domestic terrorism." Vice President Kamala Harris's niece said that violent white men are the greatest terrorist threat to our country. The editor of USA Today insisted that only an angry white man could have done such a horrible thing. And one Pakistani activist who didn't go by his real name even tweeted out the bit of false information. A white Christian terrorist killed 10 innocent people with a gun in a grocery store in Colorado. So these statements, coming based off nothing more than a photograph, really reveal the Democrat media complex's obsession with race. And you can really tell that what happened the next day when the authorities did release that the shooter was 21-year-old Ahmed Alissa. So your knee-jerk reaction when you hear the name Ahmed Alissa is correct in this case. He is Islamic. And he's from Syria. He immigrated here when he was a young child and was raised in the United States. But his now scrubbed Facebook posts, Facebook account, which they took down very quickly after the shooting, has many posts about him ranting against Islamophobia and praising the Prophet Muhammad, attacking President Donald Trump. And even scouting out both churches and Trump rally locations for potential terrorist attacks. So the man is an Islamic jihadi, which caused those same progressive journalists I mentioned earlier to really change their tune very quick when they found out, like, okay, well, yes, he is a white man, but he's an Islamic white man. And apparently giving your heart to the Prophet Muhammad wipes out the original sin of whiteness. So they dropped that angle very quickly and started focusing, well, we need to focus on not the man, not his name, but the gun control. Mm-hmm. And from Tuesday onward, we've heard very little, very little more about the shooter, but a whole bunch about the gun control. Former President Barack Obama weighed in on the issue, saying that it will take time to root out the disaffection, racism, and misogyny that fuels so many of these senseless acts of violence. But we can make it harder for those with hate in their hearts to buy weapons. We can overcome opposition by cowardly politicians and the pressure of gun lobby that opposes any limit on the ability of anyone to assemble an arsenal. And within very shortly, I think within a couple hours of him making that statement, President Joe Biden faithfully repeated his former boss's stance, saying, "I don't need to wait another minute, let alone another hour, to make common steps that will save lives in the future, and urge my colleagues in the House and Senate to act. We can ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines in this country." So that's the big takeaway. The big takeaway from the shooting is to ban assault weapons and high capacity magazines in his country. Now, Biden made a big point that he'd done this before. They actually called it the Biden Act in 1994, where they did a ban the types of guns he wanted banned for 10 years from 1994 to 2004. They did numerous studies on the effect, found that it really had a negligible or unmeasurable effect on homicides in America, so they let the ban lapse. And it's not here anymore. So it's, I guess, his point that this is the big solution to stop things that happened in Colorado is not a good point. America's done this before. It didn't help. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene noted that actually Colorado is, on the state level, has most of the gun laws that leftists are calling for. Mm-hmm. They have red flag gun seizure laws, high capacity magazine bans, universal background checks. None of that helped. So you're trying to take policies that didn't stop an Islamic terrorist attack in Colorado and apply them to the whole nation. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you don't have to think about it too hard before you realize that there's another agenda than taking policies that didn't work in Colorado and applying them to the whole nation. I mean, it's just common sense that, like, gun laws are not very effective at stopping criminals from getting guns, because if you want to commit a crime, by definition, you don't have a problem breaking the law. So if you're willing to break the nation's murder laws, you are likely willing to break the nation's gun laws.
Right.
They do have a profound effect at keeping law-abiding citizens from owning guns, which is why the U.S. Constitution had the Second Amendment in the first place. They said that the more law-abiding citizens that with a gun, the less likely the government is to step up and impose some sort of tyranny. It's like a check and balance. Our executive editor, Mr. Stephen Fleury, has a trumpet brief that went out last night where he actually quotes a report from the Mises Institute mentioning that the Soviet Union ordered all citizens to turn in their guns on December 10th, 1918, right, like, at the very beginning, like, within a year of the Russian Revolution. Mm. And then, yeah, for, like, the 70-some years after that, the effects were bad of having a government with the monopoly on force. You had 30 million people murdered, and no one could do anything about it because no one was armed. And that's the point that our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, has made over and over again in articles and in his booklet, America Under Attack, that the Second Amendment is really about establishing, or not establishing, but preventing government tyranny. And the fact that Barack Obama and Joe Biden and the radical Democrats are so insistent on this is concerning, especially when you put it together with a lot of their other authoritarian or socialist policies, that they realize that they're trying to enact socialist policies that half the American people don't want, and a large and maybe not half, but probably close to half, just won't accept. Mm-hmm. Willingly.
Right.
Willingly. So it's like I said, you're either gonna have to give up on these crazy ideas or find a way to get the segment of the population that won't accept socialist dictatorship disarmed and intimidated that they can't do anything about it.
Well, you did a very good job of dismantling a lot of nonsense that we're hearing there and making a whole lot of sense. Do go to thetrumpet.com and read this trumpet brief from Stephen Fleury, Barack Obama's Radical Gun Control Agenda, written by our executive editor, Stephen Fleury, last night. You can also subscribe to The Trumpet Brief. This is our daily email blast that we send to over 25,000 people each day, and get an article from one of our senior writers at thetrumpet.com each day. We really encourage you to take advantage of this free service. We'll link to Stephen Fleury's article and a couple of other articles from our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, about this very issue that Andrew was just describing. And we'll link to all of that in the show notes for the program today. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, an incident in Middle Eastern waters that is certain to cause your price at the pump to go up, a resumption of provocative missile tests from North Korea, Europe introducing a centralized vaccine passport, and more. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
A stunning incident that has completely shut down the Suez Canal demonstrates how vital this sea gate is to the rest of the world. For this story, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, you might have seen this story. It's been reported widely that on Tuesday there was a massive tanker container ship that kind of went sideways at a very narrow part of the Suez Canal, the southern part of the Suez Canal, where the Red Sea basically goes into the Suez Canal before you get to the Mediterranean. And so this is in the southern part of that, and it has completely blocked all traffic going through the Suez Canal for going on 3 days now. And it looks like it's probably going to be blocked for another couple of days. This ship is called the Ever Given. It's a Japanese-owned ship, but Panama-flagged ship as well. It travels between Asia and Europe, and it is absolutely loaded to the hilt, full of containers. And so it's extremely heavy, and it kind of tilted sideways. Some believe it was caused by the wind, perhaps, or something else that's been kind of tight-lipped on what actually caused this. And it's kind of run aground into one of the banks. And so they're trying to decide whether they have to offload it, some of the cargo there in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the desert, on one side at least, and then, or they can kind of dredge out underneath it to try and get it free again. So there's about, right now, 250 ships that are waiting either side of the Suez Canal to get through, be it in the Mediterranean or in the southern Red Sea. And this amounts to a lot of money that is being held up. It's about $10 billion a day travels through the Suez Canal. So all that has been halted. There are some ships now that are approaching from Asia that have decided that too much of a risk to wait for this. So they're going around Africa instead. This adds another 12 days to the journey of a ship, and where extra time is money on these for these ships, and so it's far more expensive to travel around the Cape of Good Hope in South Africa. But that's what some people are doing. And so what we're seeing right now is the extreme fragility of the global trade. 10% of seaboard trade comes through the Suez Canal. So that's 10%. That's of all of it that goes on the ocean. That's an absolute a mammoth amount. Almost $1 trillion of trade between Asia and Europe comes through the Suez Canal per year. I forget the percentage of seaborne oil. I have that stat somewhere with me, but that's quite a lot. Any oil that's going between the Persian Gulf and Europe actually travels through this area as well. And so what we're seeing right now is a lot of countries, nations, looking at how fragile this is and wondering, you know, is this going to happen again? What happens if this happens again? What can we do to try and mitigate this type of thing from happening again? Now, we look at this in a different way. We look at this in terms of biblical prophecy, because we know that something like this is going to happen again. And it is going to happen not necessarily caused by just one ship, but by Iranian actions. Mr. Fleury has wrote an article over 5 years ago. It's entitled, "Iran Gets a Stranglehold on the Middle East." And if you're following the Suez Crisis right now, you need to go and read this article, because it talks about the exact scenario we're seeing right now, what the ramifications would be from it, from a shutdown of the Suez Canal or anywhere on the Red Sea. He talks specifically about the Bab el-Mandab at the southern point of the Red Sea passageway. And he says that Iran's strategy is to basically do what this ship has done, mm-hmm. except not by blocking it by a ship, but actually using one of its militias that it controls right now in Yemen. These are the Houthis group that we talk about quite a lot, who are getting more and more power. And so, in terms of knowing that biblical prophecy, knowing that Iran is going to try and control the world trade through the Red Sea passageway, and seeing what one ship can do to just totally disrupt and cause billions of dollars of losses. That's what we're talking about now when you talk about insurance claims that are going to be made on this. Because of this one ship, you can definitely see how this prophecy can take place here in the near future.
Thank you very much, Brent. That article, Iran Gets a Stranglehold on the Middle East, you can find in the links to the show notes for today's program. Now that the Biden administration is in office in America, North Korea is acting up for the first time in a while. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, on Sunday, North Korea test-launched a couple of cruise missiles, firing those into its western sea. But those missiles didn't really make much of a splash. They didn't violate any UN resolutions against the North, and President Biden and most of America's allies mostly just dismissed them. So then on Wednesday, North Korea upped the ante quite a bit. They launched two short-range ballistic missiles, this time, into the Sea of Japan. So these are more powerful, and they're solid fuel. And because of the type of missile that was used here, it was a violation of UN Resolution 1718. So it's a more significant provocation. And President Biden did speak about this in his press conference yesterday. He pointed out the specific UN resolution that was violated, and he said he plans to keep pressure on the North. He said the ultimate goal there is complete denuclearization. So that's, you know, basically the same strategy of former President Trump, but it doesn't look like President Biden plans to get as personally involved in the whole North Korea situation as President Trump did. And I think he appears to be a little bit less optimistic about the whole thing. So it's hard to say at this point if this test on Wednesday was just a one-off or if it signals a return to a more belligerent North Korea.
Why do you suppose North Korea is timing these launches right now?
Well, the North has a history of rattling its sabers quite a lot early in the presidency of a new U.S. leader. Basically just to remind America that it's there, that it wants to leverage its nuclear weapons in exchange for, you know, economic benefits, mostly the lifting of sanctions. So it's a pattern that we've seen the North use to try to basically just test new administrations and to bring America to the negotiating table. And then these missile tests this week also come just after a trip by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and also Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. They both just visited Japan and South Korea. And it looks like they made a pretty significant breakthrough with South Korea, especially just shoring up America's alliance there that had been damaged in recent years. And then there was also some significant progress in strengthening the U.S. alliance with Japan, though not quite as dramatic there. So those developments would have been upsetting to North Korea, but even more so to China, which is North Korea's primary ally. So I think the timing of these provocative tests could very well be related to those meetings as well.
So the fact that China would be upset about the movements between the United States and South Korea, and you would see this happening from North Korea, the relationship between China and North Korea is one that China has exploited repeatedly in response to what's happening with the United States.
That's right. Yes, North Korea, you know, their primary ally is China, and China often sort of uses them as a bit of a puppet state. And back in 2017, Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury said that we should all be more vigilant and more concerned about China and about Russia than we are about North Korea. And that was even at the height of North Korea's provocations. And the reason for that is partly because China and Russia are the ones enabling all of North Korea's dangerous actions. And Mr. Fleury said that his view of that is based on Bible prophecy. He wrote, "The Bible's prophecies show that, in a sense, the North Korea crisis is a massive distraction from the real threat posed by China and Russia. These powerful Asian nations are the only reason North Korea is able to operate so freely, and Bible prophecy shows that they pose a threat many times greater than the one from North Korea." end quote. So just this week, we also saw North Korean leader Kim Jong-un exchange messages with Xi Jinping, the Chinese president. They reaffirmed their alliance in those messages. So that really supports what Mr. Fleury said there. And the prophecies that he referred to, they're recorded in Ezekiel, Daniel, and Revelation mainly. And these passages show that in the end time, Russia and China will lead a powerful Asiatic military bloc. And that bloc could very well include North Korea. I think it likely will. But North Korea would not be a major player. It's really all about Russia and China. And all of that is thoroughly explained in our free booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy.
All right. Thank you for that, Jeremiah. Governments the world over have used COVID-19 to assert more control over their peoples. This week, the European Commission introduced a powerful measure to that end. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, on March 17th, the European Commission officially unveiled their new plans for a digital vaccine passport. And, you know, wow, there's a lot to talk about, I think, on the whole issue of vaccine passports. So that I don't let this get too big, I just want to focus probably more on the European aspect of this. You know, this is something that's being talked about for different countries all around the world. This is, you know, it's a very potentially dangerous move. You know, they're talking about it in Britain, they've got it in Israel, where if you want to participate in modern life, you have to show this passport that says that you've got state authority to do so. That's got all of that's somehow linked with your medical records and your most private information. With the European Union, there is an additional aspect to this on top of that. And that is this further centralization as well, that this isn't just one government, giving you some kind of passport that then follows you around. This is a union of 26 governments coming together and sharing their citizens' most private details and creating one centralized database. So I think in the European Union, it takes on an even bigger significance now, that it's not just a step towards government power, but it's also a step, an important step in European Union power and European integration. So the European Commission unveiled this new digital vaccine passport on March 17th. As I said, they're being called green passports. The European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, she held an event in Brussels talking about how this would help safely restore freedom of movement to the European Union. And there are a lot of interesting different factors of this. One is, for example, that you look at who is involved. One of the companies involved is a German-based tech startup called Uber, and they specialize in blockchain technology, this alternative to a database that instead of storing all of information in one centralized database, kind of encodes it in a unique way to prevent these digital records from being forged, from being formed. Now, this kind of centralized database just hasn't really existed before within Europe. The closest is Europol, where they did create a kind of anti-terrorism database, and there's talk of building this database or this blockchain, however they end up setting it up, on top of the Europol setup. So we're seeing more and more of this shift to the central government. And then what this will mean is, if you're a German and you want to go on holiday to Italy, you can do that, and there'll be this centralized system that allows Italian authorities to check with your German health records that you have had the vaccine.
These types of emergency measures are taken to fix this immediate problem without really considering the ramifications of them. But there are actually some Europhiles who've been looking for the means to amplify the federal power of the EU. And this is really consistent with what we would expect, these kinds of measures based on biblical prophecies about Europe.
Right. I mean, this, I think, is arguably why Europe's COVID response has been such a shambles, because the people responsible took those decisions not to say what's going to be the most effective way to deal with this problem, or what's the most, what's the quickest way to get the most vaccines, even if you're looking to vaccines as a solution. Instead, every decision was taken with the European Union in mind. You know, what is going to push us closer towards a European superstate, which is why the European Union very quickly kind of started working at the vaccines at the federal level, when Europe at the federal level has no experience with doing this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I think if they were going for what was, if they were trying to answer what's most effective, they, this would, their response to the pandemic would have looked very different. But this response of how can we use this crisis to bring Europe together, this is what we've been looking for all along. I thought it was really remarkable, kind of right in the, I guess in hindsight, we could call it the early stages of the pandemic. Over the summer, we had an article from Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry called Coronavirus and the Holy Roman Empire. And I don't know of any other news commentator that really this was the big thing that they were zoomed in on for what to watch for from the fallout for coronavirus. You know, he was right early in the early stages of that pandemic. His Key of David on the subject was even earlier. Watch how Europe takes advantage of this crisis to become, you know, well, watch how this causes a crisis for Europe. And he talked about a number of different ways that this is causing problems for Europe. And then watch how Europe takes advantage of those crises to integrate. And the reason why Mr. Flurry was on that right from the start is because of very specific Bible prophecies. The Bible prophesies some massive changes for Europe. A lot of that article is built around Revelation chapter 17 and this Europe that's described there that is both a, you know, strongly related to what we see now, but also has some significant changes. There's a much bigger role for religion in this Europe. That's, you know, it's a Europe dominated by a church. It's a Europe that's dominated by kings, not democracies. You start to put this picture together. How do you get that kind of big change? And it's through crisis and it's through catastrophe. And you can go back even to the Amos booklet, one of the first booklets Mr. Flurry wrote, and he's talking about how it will take a crisis to bring these changes about. So he made that forecast really early on based on those Bible prophecies. He made them early on even with the coronavirus rollout. And that is exactly what we're seeing with all of these ongoing bits of news that we get coming out of Europe. It's just a you know, there's a lot of negative in the coronavirus news story, but this story, as we see it play out in Europe, is just a fantastic confirmation of, you know, the Bible's analysis of end time events, and that it is all unfolding and toward according to the plan that God has set out there.
Boy, we have seen that pattern unfold time after time, where you have Mr. Gerald Flurry so far ahead of the curve on a news story like this. We do encourage you to go back and look at that article, Coronavirus and the Holy Roman Empire. We'll link to that in the show notes for today's program. Thank you very much for that, Richard. We'll finish with a story about massive flooding in Australia. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, half of the United States is currently in drought, but in Australia, they're experiencing a very different problem. Last week, March 18th to be specific, a huge storm system hit eastern Australia, causing catastrophic flooding and submerging parts of New South Wales with almost 3 feet of water. The capital city of Sydney was hit especially hard. With the dam, there's a local dam there that's actually pouring out the equivalent of Sydney Harbor every day. It's flooded over, so you just have water pouring out the top. So altogether, this has affected probably about 10 million people. I mean, thankfully, very few have died, but thousands have had to evacuate. And even those who haven't had to evacuate have experienced some of the ripple effects from all of this flooding. I saw one particularly disturbing video online of this man's fence. His yard wasn't flooded. He must have been far enough away from the water, but it was covered with thousands and thousands of spiders that apparently had lived in the areas that got flooded and have had to, they had to evacuate like the people did. And particularly concerning in Australia, because here we've got a couple spiders that if they bite you, you'll give you a nasty rash. But some of the ones they have down there are particularly deadly, ones they'd probably prefer living in the swamp or wherever they came from instead of on your fence. So between dislocated animals and housing evacuations, I mean, this is going to cost, I haven't seen financial estimates yet, but it'll cost millions and millions of dollars for this natural disaster. Yeah, so and it really does bring to mind, especially concerning that point I made at the beginning about the drought in the western United States and the flooding in eastern Australia, a particular prophecy in Amos, Amos 4, verse 7, that says, "And I have withholden rain from you, and I have caused it to rain upon one city and caused it to not rain upon another city. One piece was rained upon, and the piece whereupon it rained not withered." And so you could definitely, if you're looking at like a tale of two cities, Sydney, Australia, and Salt Lake City, Utah, definitely fit that prophecy in Amos right now, where it's you've got the equivalent of Sydney Harbor pouring over a dam into Sydney each day, and Salt Lake City, Utah, is in extreme drought, some of its most extreme drought in 500 years. So that's definitely this prophecy that God says that he curses with weather disasters when his people turn away from him. But there's definitely weather disasters come in many shapes and forms, whether it's earthquake or fire or flood or drought. And these different types of disasters are occurring around the world. But you definitely can tell that whether you're underwater or in desperate need of water, something is wrong.
Well, if it's easy to overlook these kinds of events, particularly when every time something like this happens, people blame it on climate change. But that spiritual dimension that Andrew was just describing is definitely worth looking into and studying your Bible to understand. We have a booklet called Why Natural Disasters that we'll link to in the show notes that is definitely worth studying. I am Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Nachtigall. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of John the Baptist: "Behold the Lamb of God, which takes away the sin of the world." Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
To Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.